Get ready. It's time to tee it up with Keith Jones.
Coming up on today's show, we check in with our putter industry insider, John Berquist, for the latest designs and the latest releases. So stay tuned and get ready as you tee it up with Keith Jones. Welcome to the show. So glad to be along. This hour, we wanted to check in with one of our industry insiders, a guy who knows the putter world about at least as good as Scotty Cameron, if not better. And, you know, there's Bettinardi in there. There's a lot of great people making a lot of great putters. But John Berquist is our go-to guy. He can talk to you about technology, design. Well, if you listen to the show, you've heard him before. He is one of our regular contributors, and we welcome JB to the show. Thanks for making time. It's time to talk a little bit of putter action because the PGA show is only a mere couple months away now.
Oh, thanks for reminding me, Keith. I'm not sure if I wanted that reminder quite now, but thanks for having me on.
Hey, no problem. I heard there might be a John Berquist sighting in Orlando. That's why I brought that up. From now until, and I talked to one of my inside people at the PGA Merchandise Show, and we'll talk about the information that I gathered today. It's crazy what's going on in our industry, and apparently it's standing room only at the Orlando show. But anyway, I digress on that. We're here to talk some putters, and there are a number of putters that are out. Scotty's got a new putter out. Odyssey is now coming out, I think, on the 14th of December. That's been embargoed, although the new embargo is not the old embargo as we know. Embargo just mean, you know, you had to hold the news. Now it means something totally different, like tariff, you know. So people are like, what? The embargo? What? What happened there? So we have to make sure we kind of explain that along the way for the people who are a little less familiar with what goes on in this wacky industry of ours.
Well, like you stated, there's a couple new entries into the center shafted world, both by Scotty and by Odyssey. And I guess we could start there. I mean, it's not like it's anything new.
Wait, what do you mean? That $600, that seven, how much is a Scotty going to cost me now?
Well, I could probably find that out quickly, but I can tell you right now, the new white hot, what is it? The Odyssey Tri-Hot Square.
Yep.
Two square Rossi right-handed is $550.
Ooh. Bargain.
Well, it is what it is. I'm not too disappointed in that as someone who, you know, tries to make a living selling product. But, you know, you start baking some cool technology into it, you know, you got to pay designers something. And, you know, it's sort of like this going away price right now. I mean, putters, you know, all of a sudden are creeping up where it's like, what can I get for under $500? And, you know, there's still some options, but limited.
Yeah, well, you know, speaking of limited, Scotty's a good guy, so we kid tongue in cheek. But there are people that collect the Cameron putters, Brad Faxon being one of them. But it's like collecting Jordan sneakers, you know. So there you go. So Cameron putters are right up in that same stratosphere.
They are. It's interesting to see how many people can make a living on, you know, collector's items and a limited edition and sort of like special campaigns that are around these drops. And you can kind of ask what your brands can command. Some of the stuff I've done, you know, been sub-1,000, but most of the partnerships I've done with other industry brands that are out there that are trying to push either, you know, apparel or their accessories, they have no problem commanding $1,500, $1,700. And if you really want to talk about Scotty Cameron and those collector, you know, prices, I don't, you know, if you don't have $5,000 in your pocket to go get a Circle T, you know, well, you're not playing the same game that other people are. So they are collector's items, and I think we're going to see an evolution of how that experience kind of like migrates itself. So if we're used to sort of like buying a product and it's in a display case, most people are going to probably not use these if there's some sort of commodity that they want to, you know, add to their collections. It's there. It's sitting there. It's a tangible object. All of a sudden, if we start to introduce ways that there's a sort of a tokenism or a digital transaction that can be bought and sold also. We're going to probably see more and more of that when it comes to the collector series, especially in hard goods.
Well, it's interesting because it's like Jay Leno and his car collection. You put them in a garage and you don't use them. So, I mean, are people that collect Scotty's putters ever going to actually hit them besides maybe in their putter room where they keep them?
Well, yeah, there's probably the go-to, right? Like, these people have no problem spending that kind of money on a putter they want to use every day, but they're going to have their collection and definitely some they're not going to touch, probably the majority of them. And again, these are not just, you know, products you're buying, for instance, from other collectors. You know, Scotty puts on these events where he has, you know, huge types of, you know, 2-3 day events globally where the top 100, 200 collectors congregate and, you know, honestly have like bid offs on what he's unveiling for that specific season. So it's exciting. It's a lot of fun that those type of arenas exist, not just for Scotty, but other club manufacturers, and you know, I look at that as, you know, how much of my time do I want to devote towards that experience versus selling, you know, a few thousand, and if it's Lab's case, a few hundred thousand putters a year.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic for sure. But it, when you talk about 200, the number is not really a large number. But then you take that multiplier of 5,000 or whatever that thousand number is, all of a sudden it becomes quite a good bit of money.
Yeah, and again, I think it's exciting. You know, if you look at other types of collectors in the world or in that space, you know, dropping $10,000-$20,000 on a single putter or a single article that they want to put into their collection, you know, maybe an afterthought. Not for most people, but I mean, I think those people who are the top 100 to 200 collectors, if we're talking specifically about Scotty Cameron, you know, they aren't always an individual. They could be a corporation that, again, just is adding this to their commodity sort of quiver. But yeah, I mean, it's a lot of fun because when you start to talk about what a designer can do, and you have material selections and other, you know, amazing performance attributes, you know, that you can put into these things, because now you can, you know, have a blank check to go after a specific, you know, one-off. Manufacturing, you know, can I 3D print the whole damn thing out of titanium or magnesium or whatever it may be and justify a price tag that warrants sort of, you know, north of, you know, five digits, and you know, you never know, but it's fun to think about.
Yeah, so when you look at the Odyssey, and Odyssey is obviously a Callaway brand, and their White Hot series was when the White Hot original was unbelievable, and they did tremendous sales for that company, and they've since bought Sean Toulon's company as well. So when you look at the new Odyssey that's out, what's the attraction? Again, is it name value equal to the design? Where does that mix come in? What is that happy blend?
Oh, you know, the White Hot itself, you know, is an insert. Yes, it's been other lines, but primarily that was named after, like you said, this material and a density and a specific feel that was, you know, initiated in this insert. And so they've, what, I don't know, 8 or 10 other types of inserts that have been launched in the last 30 years, but they keep coming back to this White Hot. And so, you know, again, why? You know, you have X amount of pace that you want to put on a golf ball. It's pretty consistent, and it's a barometer up against, you know, stainless steel. And so people just feel very comfortable with that feedback and resonance and performance of a White Hot. We talk about design and how they continue to evolve it throughout different iterations, whether it be, you know, annually or seasonal. That's the fun part, right? Now we have a technology that we can put into anything. What is, you know, quote unquote, no pun intended, what's hot right now? And right now what's white hot is center shafted and then the concept of zero torque. That's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing, you know, this week with both companies, Odyssey and Scotty, looking at emphasizing an onset shaft, center shafted, where you are running the CG up the axis plane. And so you know, it's not hard to do that from an engineering or design standpoint. It's like, what do you do to the shape that can bring people in? And so I'm looking at the latest, the Tri-Hot, the square-to-square, and it's kind of what ROM's playing right now. It's that sort of C-shaped back, but it's cool. I mean, it's a nod to some of the Nike method stuff that we saw 10, 12 years ago, but I like it. That's my personal opinion. It's different. I'm glad to see Odyssey going in a direction that's their own. So you start marrying up cool design with a classic insert people trust, the name of Odyssey, and now the in vogue center shaft, zero torque, which, by the way, there's no such thing as zero torque. There's low torque. But that's something pretty cool. I mean, it's something that I would definitely be checking out if I had the option to get to it after the embargo is lifted.
Well, you know, and that's part of why we're having John Berkowitz on, because he's a guy that knows. He told you there's no such thing as zero torque. All right, so we get right down to it and such. But, you know, a lot of it is marketing. And I go back 25-ish years in the industry directly, and we've seen so much stuff come out over the years. And Nike was great about this, because Nike really – they do manufacture some things, but like the golf ball, they didn't manufacture their golf ball, but they know how to market. And that's one of those things. You mentioned the Nike putter. I have one of those Nike putters, and every once in a while I pull it out and say, does this thing still work? Well, you know, actually, it does on certain days. Other days, not so much, but, you know. But the point is, and I think that Jesse Ortiz, a great Jesse Ortiz from TriMetal and Bobby Jones said this on the show numerous times. You know, it's like what's old is new again. There's nothing really new, and it's hard to come up with something new. You know, and I go back, harken back to Dick De La Cruz, who had the Hickory Shaft company that Ely Calloway bought. And Dick said on this show that, you know, you're working, you're always striving to come up with these composites that'll work together, but it's really, really difficult to do it. And that's hence the R&D part, the research and development part. But then once that comes together, then you have to get it out and market it to the masses and try to sell as many pieces of, in this case, putters as you can.
Yeah, I mean, well, you kind of got to go with what the marketing people are telling you. And right now, to avoid a center shaft and low torque, zero torque story onset, like you're missing out on like what drove it forever, which was MOI. Like, who, it's a race to who can get the highest MOI out of the smallest shape. There's opportunity, and I think that the fun part when you start to look at where shaft placement is, where lie placement is, how you can personalize it for the golfer, there's opportunity now within sort of, you know, the check boxes of what's in vogue. So that's where I'm excited to see what other companies are doing. But internally here, like, that's a big focal point. And looking at how to get IP in that space. And, you know, there's a couple companies I could nod to right now that I think are doing some fun stuff around that. But I don't want to give away what I'm doing, too. So just know that there's people looking at forms of modularity that we're probably going to see more and more of over the next probably, you know, year or so.
Interesting. As we're talking with our Teed Up Industry Insider, especially when it comes to design and putters, that's John Berkowitz at the Great Northwest out in Seattle, where he's got a secret laboratory out there, and we'll tell you a little bit about that as the show goes on. But he's spending the hour with us. Lots more ahead, and we look forward to it with JB after this break.
Hi, this is John O'Hurley reminding you you're listening to Tee It Up with Keith Jones. I haven't been this excited since I discovered I couldn't lick my elbow.
We are back, and we are rolling already this hour as John Berkowitz, our industry insider, joins us. One of our industry insiders, this case, it's putters and technology and such, and trying to help not only the listeners, as consumers, have a true idea of what really is going on, what's behind the curtain, but also what's the affordability rate. Because I know guys that will go out and they will buy whatever the latest is because they think that's going to help their game. And there are other people that either are leery to spend hundreds of dollars on one club and go in a different direction. So for those all encompassed, I know it's difficult for you to kind of break it down and such and send people in one direction or another, but there are a lot of companies. I mean, even the main manufacturers, TaylorMade is really trying to step up their game putter-wise, and Ping is a long-standing player in the putter, and that goes back to the Answer, and they've had other models come out over the years and stuff, and Carson Sohan changed the industry greatly when he was spearheading Ping Golf and making things happen in Arizona. And we were fortunate enough to have gone out to that facility years ago and watched it. And you walk in, and really, JB, it's like you walked into somebody's garage and they're putting clubs together. And not much has changed over the years from that. It's still a very man-made, we'll say, certainly a crafted craft.
Everyone's duty is basically the same, right? I think that you're looking at adhesives, solvents, you know, you have your own tool set of different screws and, you know, other adhesives. So at the end of the day, you can have some really nice storage and, you know, nice shafts and things of that nature that are going to fill up anyone's studio. It's just a matter of, at the end of the day, we're all kind of doing the same thing. Like, how much can we extract from, you know, sort of just the idea of assembly versus the idea of technology and innovation. And, you know, to go back to what you were stating, like, what does it cost to, like, enter the putter market right now? Just while we've been talking, I pulled up the new Scotty center shaft. It's the studio-style fastback OC center putter. It released, or it's going to be released on the 14th of this month, and it's $549. And as I stated beforehand, Odyssey and their latest center shaft, same price, $549. You go to Lab, the DF3, $549. I think the Oz is $599. So there it is. Like, and if you, and again, I think TaylorMade's about $100 less, $450 for their zero torque putter. So again, like, those are pretty much the ones that are dominating the space right now, and they're starting at $450 for the basic model of TaylorMade, and looks like the basic model even for Scotty is at $550. Obviously with different shaft configurations and custom features, you can push that number up pretty quickly. But, you know, out the door with tax, I mean, if you don't really spend $650 to $700, well, you're not buying what the competition has out there.
So how does somebody choose what is right for them? Because you can't, well, I don't want to say, there are people that can do this, go out and buy all these putters and try them. And sometimes you try to go to a superstore or someplace like that and knock them around. But you can't get a real feel on the synthetic small putting green that they have in a lot of these stores. So how can you personally help people try to figure that out?
I don't know if that's my job.
It's not right. Your job. It's a favor to me. I know. It's
just, right. No, me, no. My job is, I think, to the public, Keith. It's like, okay, there's so many different things based on arc that we can talk about that would drive someone towards, let's just say, a blade style versus a mallet, a center versus a heel shaft, onset versus offset. So I think that swing path pretty much is the number one generator of, you know, putting someone into a matrix and what bucket they may fall into. You know, right now, with a center shaft being sort of the, you know, go-to from all these OEMs and thinking that's where marketing should be putting money, you're pushing people towards that more, you know, square-to-square, less arcing putter stroke. So there's going to be a lot of options there, but I think, you know, from a fitting standpoint, whether it be a coach or whether it be, you know, going down to a retailer, they're going to have people who have, you know, a decent enough idea of your, you know, current swing path and then putting you into that putter versus here's what the technology out there in the industry is saying you should do and then readjust your technique to fit their technology. And I'm not, you know, I've been out on tour enough to know that that's the biggest barrier to entry, is if you're having to alter someone's swing path that they've invested thousands and thousands of hours into, and they're a pretty good putter as is, you're going to want to fit that swing.
With John Berquist, heading to the bottom of the hour. We'll be back.
The Dalai Lama. So I'm on a first tee with him. I give him the driver. He hauls off and whacks one. Big hitter.
The Lama.
Long. Into a 10,000-foot crevice right at the base of this glacier. You know what the Lama says? Gunga Galunga. Gunga, Gunga Galunga.
We're back to start the second half hour of the show, spending it with our Teed Up Industry Insider. Putting-wise, John Berquist, this guy knows a bunch of stuff. Well, you heard him before in the last segment before we went to the break about the importance of swing path, and you certainly think that's the number one thing, whether you're doing the barn door or whether you're doing the back and forth or whatever it may be.
Everyone has a preference, and then all of a sudden, you know, preference is driven by made putts, and that's confidence, and that all imparts, you know, the initiation of making a good quality stroke. And if you can repeat that, who am I to tell you what that needs to be? You know, fortunately, I don't have to worry about, you know, providing a budget to my sales staff to cover the cost of those goods that are being sold. I can look at it from a standpoint of technology says that this specific part of the club can do what? You know, a stiffer shaft can then dampen vibration potentially, and then where that position is can, prevent twisting upon contact, and then what we do with the face technology that starts to put, you know, feel and resonance, and then if you put geometry on the face, that can start to impart, you know, more of positive roll versus skidding. So all those things are performance driven, but I just think that I personally am looking at what the industry and why more bigger OEMs don't try and take that stance. Like, we're not experts in who or what you should be using, but we have a massive sort of like spread of offerings, and we can help fit you into that. So, you know, whether or not we're the ones who are telling you what you should be, but it's sort of like, hey, this profile fits this specific putter, this profile fits this specific arc stroke. So yeah, I'd like to see the industry expand out of this phase of center shaft and being like the, you know, gold standard for every single, you know, player that's out there.
Yeah, I totally would agree with that. It's just such a convoluted area. And if you're going to break into the golf industry, usually it's by way of putter. So it's becoming increasingly more difficult to do that. However, that is about the easiest way to get in there, because the professionals, especially if you go that route and you want to get your club into a bag on whatever tour it is, professionally speaking, a lot of the manufacturers that have those players under contract try to lock down the 14 club deal now versus leaving that putter available before. So it definitely makes a difference and makes it increasingly difficult, but people still want to get into the golf industry.
Well, it's fun. I mean, again, all of a sudden you start mixing, you know, business with pleasure. You better make sure that you have a great story to tell. And this is where, you know, I'd never try and sway someone from entering the golf space. But you better have a story that's compelling where you can have an audience that you're kind of like just crafting on your own. So for, you know, those who want to jump into the putter industry and, you know, start with the baseline of what you just stated, Keith, it's really challenging to go that route of tour-driven sales or tour-driven validation. I think it's now experiential. And so as we see, you know, the baseline, let's just say it's $500 to get into any of the big OEMs, sort of like basic center shaft. What can I get for $1,000? What can I get for $1,500? And yes, it's more expensive, but if you're taking the standpoint of a new sort of like offering into the space, I don't think you're going to make a ton of money if you're going to try and compete at $500. Now, if you can make it out of a cast piece of plastic and put some metal in there and it only costs you $50 and you want to sell it for $400, you can do that, but I'd still focus on marketing D2C. There's space, though, on the other end, where there's going to be companies who can do something that's pretty darn special, not just a newly machined putter or the shape of it, but like offer something that's really, really white gloved. And if you sell it for $2,000, well, you're going to find 1,000 people that probably want that over a couple year span, and it's a decent living.
I have not personally played with too many center shafted putters, but I had one put in my hand recently. It's the Drac center putter by Newton Shafts. Now, Newton made a huge inroads with the, especially the, I'll call them seniors, on the senior tour with the shafts, interchangeable shafts and stuff, and they've then gum out with these putters. And it's interesting because in playing with this putter most recently, there's a lot of weight in the head, which I like because I like a little heavier putter, but the shaft is light, everything else about it is light. And then I was able to actually put my finger, index finger, near the hosel, and you could see how balanced that club was. So it's pretty comfortable. It's interesting, but the center shaft is definitely a different animal, especially when you're used to. I'm usually not playing a mallet. I'm usually playing a blade, and wanted to try it out. And because I think at times I tend to unintentionally twist, or I certainly can pull the ball. Feel like a field goal kicker sometimes, missing to the left from that standpoint. But that's trying to get that pure roll out of it. But yeah, it's definitely different. No question about that.
Yeah, and it takes a while for people to adopt it, but with the success of Lab, it's and again, incredible marketing. They've permeated a large, market space, and shifted kind of like this concept of center shafted being that's the one we want to migrate you to, and they're going to be pushed by all major OEMs right now. I been in the space a long time and had center shafted putters tested 15 years ago, and they performed very, very well. It's an easier club to hit, right? Less twisting also off the face. You're having lower torque. There's always a lot of benefits behind that. And again, it's why they banned anything upwards of, 80 plus degrees, because, you start having this side, like true side saddle, or getting the lie angles, beyond that, it becomes easier to putt the ball. So, that's just physics. And so we're basically eliminating human error by doing so. And it's cool. It's fun to see, for years and years and years, it was MOI and where people were driving that. And then, you got to, play around with a lot of different shapes. We've seen everything under the sun, but, now right today, and probably for the next, 18 months, center shafts are going to drive the market.
All right. So we're talking to John Berquist, our industry insider, especially when it comes to putters. We'll see about, supposedly there'll be a sighting in Orlando at the end of January, where we've been going for a long time. So hopefully that actually does happen. We're expecting to see a bunch of people down there. It is getting crazy already. It looks like the show is oversold, so there'll be exhibitors in the hallways. So I don't know how it's being orchestrated all by Reed Exhibitions, but they know how to do it. They put on a good show, and we will see. There's a lot of excitement around the game of golf. It's still not at the professional level. I think fewer people are watching golf on television and following the tours. But when it comes to playing and such, I think we're still in an uptick, which is great to finally see. It's a kind of stayed steady and going in the right direction versus trending down and such.
It's exciting times. It really is. we're right in the mix of when tours are on their own. We're going to see probably some world golf rankings that are now allocated for LIV. Now they're moving to a 72 hole tournament. So, I think there's going to be an interesting future and probably a, you know, somewhat of NFC versus AFC. Somewhere down the road will be something like
that. Well, you know, and you mentioned LIV, and I'll expound on that, because there's a guy that plays on LIV that's won some U.S. Opens that is the current day version changing the game in one Bryson DeChambeau. And this is a guy, he's an innovative guy. He's always looking, he's always tweaking, he's always experimenting. It is insane to think about getting into his mind, because I don't know, it'd be some kind of amusement ride which you've never seen before from that standpoint. But he is a fan favorite, thus people follow him and they will continue to kind of emulate him, if you will. There aren't too many professional players that move the needle when it comes to clubs that they use. But Bryson seems to be one of the exceptions on that, and people are closely watching what he plays and how he plays and what is next around the corner for Bryson.
You know, he's one of the few guys who are heavily vested in several hard good manufacturers. You know, he has a grip company. He's part of LA Golf Shafts. He's part of Sick Putters, who's owned by LA Golf. Probably Golf Balls. I mean, like, he has his fingers in a lot of different pots, which, you know, that's his love. So I'm hoping, and this is to all those players out there that want to get into hard goods, take control of your game. I mean, there's plenty of companies who would love to partner with, you know, great tour players or even amazing amateurs if they've got some good name and likeness, and see what they can come up with. But Bryson's the one who, you know, is actually playing products that he owns.
Yeah, but he's had a hand in designing those as well. So that's really the nice thing. And I think back to Scottie Scheffler, who helped kick off Golf Forever, the training aid, and how well they have done. But Scottie uses it. When you use it and you see the results, I mean, there's nobody virtually better on the planet on the golf course than a guy named Scottie. So you take that for what it is, true. but you know, that makes a huge difference, and the guy is constantly using that product, so you buy into it easier when you're a consumer, because you actually see it and you know that the guy's not being paid to play it. You know, I mean, it is a little bit of a rub when a player has part of the company, but that's also part of what the company's doing, right? The company says, I have this affiliation with John Daly, or I have this affiliation with Scottie Scheffler or Bryson or whoever it may be, and that moves the needle.
Oh, tremendously, right? The instant, you know, validity. That's the key. Like, however you get that, there's your spark, run with it. Now, can you afford the marketing that needs to be pumped into the thing? It does make a difference. It's one thing when you see the commercial, but it's another thing when you see someone using it out on the course or out in practice. And, you know, it's pretty obvious when people are necessarily not getting paid for that segment, but they believe in it and it comes across really authentic. So you're right. Like, those are the authentic experiences, and the, you know, greater the name and likeness, the more, you know, again, your audience is to sort of like, oh, wow, that's believable. And if you have a 50 million person following, it can equate to sales.
Yeah, and that's that's the bottom line. The bottom line is the bottom line. So we're talking to John Berquist, one of our industry insiders on TW Keith Jones. And you mentioned along the way 3D printing. And it always intrigues me, and I probably have asked you different ways on this show in the past about it. But what exactly, for those of us who are not 3D printer literate, what is it, and how does it actually print something like a golf club?
All right, well, just think of an avocado, right? You take it out, and then most people just don't eat the avocado. They cut it, and they slice it. And so that's, in theory, or a slice of bread. That's probably a better analogy. If you were to build bread in a box, right, you basically have material that's laying down layers, at a very sort of, you know, say microscopic, but a very, very thin layer, and that builds in the X, Y, and then the Z is the, you know, the actual material that's building upon. And so, you know, you do some CAD work, it reads the file, and it basically extrapolates that into, you know, a machine that's just laying down a bead of material. And so it's, you know, primarily been plastics that we all have access to, and you can go out and buy a really nice 3D printer on Amazon for, you know, less than $1,000. And the fun part is you get these wide range of materials that you can print with, but it's still plastic. And when you start to talk about 3D printing metals, that's completely different. I mean, to get into a 3D printed machine that can basically print, you know, only one material, you're talking $500,000 investment. It just, that's what it costs. And it, and the challenge with 3D printing is trying to scale. And so you take this layering, and I think people can wrap their mind around that. But the bed, or, you know, the build area is only so big. And so you start to try and do some math and how many products we can build in this specific volume of real estate, and then multiply that by the number of units that you need to make. Last time I checked with one of my contract manufacturers, I think we could do around, I think it was 28 mallets every 3 days in one machine. That's not very many, right? So how many machines do I need to print 2,800 a week? So again, there's cycle time that's costly, and you know, we're not quite there yet. We're printing up 1,000 putters at a time, but I'm sure someone somewhere is. But you know, as we see these patents that are, you know, Cobra's gone after, and ones that, you know, Callaway has gone after, you know, I guess the question from any industry is like, can you actually patent a process like that? So my attorneys are saying that you can't, and I think it's a fantastic way that anyone can get into this space if you can get your hands on some, you know, CAD models and see what you can do. But again, it's not that it's expensive still.
Wow, interesting. So when we come back, we're going to get into the patent side of it, and hopefully we're keeping everybody awake. John Berquist is pretty animated, if you couldn't tell. You know, yes, I know. He's excited right now. That's how putter designers get when they're in their secret workshop all day long. It takes a little while for them to get the energy up, and they just keep going. They keep going. They're like the Ever Ready Bunny. That's just the way it works. So when we come back for our final break, we'll get into patents, and we'll also talk about things that you can do to put weight on your putter, whether it should be in the head, whether it should be in the housel, whether it should be in the shaft. Well, JB knows all that stuff, and we'll do that when we come back on Teed Up with Keith Jones.
Hi, this is David Ledbetter. Teed Up with Keith Jones, the best golf show on the radio.
We are back to wrap up the show. It's been a pretty quick hour, as we've been delighted to be joined by John Berquist, our putter industry insider, and a guy who knows about 3D printers. He knows about center shafts. He knows about zero torque, which doesn't exist, according to JB. And he also knows about patents. So what is it that takes? It's a lot of paperwork. It's a lot of stuff to get your patent. How do you, when you go to a patent office, and I'm speaking from the golf industry, because even Kevin Plank, when he came out with Under Armour, dealt with this, because it's you can manufacture or patent a process, but you can't patent a material. I think that's what he told me. I'm trying to remember. I'm paraphrasing. I suffer from CRS, so any given time, I may not remember anything. So from that standpoint, patent-wise, what is the deal?
I mean, the utility patents that patents a specific innovation or a program or a process. And then you have design patents, which are more shape-driven. And you have there's number of categories that they fall into, but those are two of the primary ones. And then there's trademarks, and trademarks have to do with, kind of design in a 2D arena, would be fonts or logos. Those are primarily the three areas that I play in: design patents, utility patents, and trademarks. They all have value. They all have value to the industry. They all have value to your company. It's fun to have ownership in, one, if not all three of those. Start off with a provisional patent. You could probably do it on one of these LegalZoom type of online document download, pay the fee type of services. I have a great set of, a couple attorneys that I've been trusting for a long time, and it's about $1,000 to $1,200 to do your provisional, which kind of puts your flag in the sand, gives it a timestamp, and you have 1 year to file your formal USPTO patent, and you can kind of scale that up from a protection in the states to then individual countries that you want to patent that product or process around. And that number all of a sudden jumps to, $10,000 minimum. So there it is. You kind of got to, look at the value of what you're asking to do or wanting to patent and how you're going to get there. This is where the world of AI has been very fascinating, because you can ask it certain prompts and it will write the provisional patent claims for you. And then you can start to revise them. And, instead of it taking, 3 weeks and several thousands of dollars that you're spending on attorneys or copywriters, you can do it through AI, and it's free, and it's amazing. So, you still got to spend the money for the initial provisional patent application. You could probably get it for $500, but if you can find the time to kind of just make sure you're getting everything filed correctly, you got a year to then go get your, true application filed, and wait minimum 6 months, probably closer to a year and a half. And if you're lucky, you get your application granted, and you're then assigned a USPTO patent number. And it's value for millions and millions and millions of people around the world. And I explore almost, 20 times a week.
Well, it's interesting because the Chinese don't really care about those kind of things. So, not to single them out, but that's where a lot of the manufacture historically has taken place, because the counterfeit market for golf is millions of dollars. It is insane.
Oh, goodness sake, yeah. I mean, again, that's, think about it. It's more of form that they're ripping off, not even necessarily technology. So if, I can go to Alibaba right now, type in the three letters of LAB, add golf behind it, and you're going to see all of them. You're going to see the Mez, you're going to see the DF3, you're going to see the Mez Max. Someone out there is doing it. And, it's the company's role to try and shut those people down. I mean, that's what you're trying to do. When it comes to actually selling in the United States, this is where the idea of certain authenticity word marks or, let's just say serial numbers were in play. But now I think even Cobra is doing your specific codes that you can scan, your QR codes on the actual products themselves. So it showcases the origin date. So, I think a lot of companies are trying to figure out ways to showcase what is an authentic product versus what's not. It's getting more and more sophisticated, but at the end of the day, I think consumers, if you can buy a DF3 from Alibaba, you got to order 10 of them and they're $50 each. There'll be people that go that way too and try and swindle the public.
Hey, thanks so much for the information, John Berquist, our industry insider regarding putters and technology. My guest on Tee It Up with Keith Jones. Get out there and practice your game, because we are out of time. Practice, use a good putter. Take your game to the next level, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care.